Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Robertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Francis, is that pronounced Janice?
Janice,
all right. Appellant versus Nash Finch Company, Appalachia. For the appellant, Mr. Janice, we have Mr. George Nelson, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the defendant, Nash Finch, we have attorney Craig Pfeifley, also from Rapid City. The court would like to welcome Ms. Merkel and the 35 students from Loyola High School and hope you find your visit to the South Dakota Supreme Court educational. With that, Mr. Nelson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. May it please the court, opposing counsel, Mr. Pfeifley. My name is George Nelson. I represent the appellant in this case, Francis Janice. This is an appeal from a trial court's ruling granting summary judgment to the defendant, Nash Finch Company. The appellant here appeals on two main issues. Before I get to those issues, I'd like to give the court some background about this case.
I think that'd be helpful.
My client, Francis Janice, on the 28th of January 2004, attempted to enter the Prairie Market grocery store in Rapid City. It was approximately 15 after 7 o'clock a.m. on that morning, and he proceeded to enter the west side of the north. Now, there are two sets of doors on this building, on the north side of the building. One set faces east, the other set faces west, but they're both on the north side of the building. As Mr. Janice left the parking lot, he attempted to enter the west set of doors on the north side of the building. These doors are automatic doors, and he approached the door. With automatic doors, there's a sensor. They open automatically. He attempted to step into the building. His first step was on a service rug, a serval rug, commonly used in commercial businesses. This first step resulted in the rug slipping from underneath of him. He fell to the ground. He had attempted to get back up, and in attempting to get back up, he fell again. After the second fall, and looking down as to what he was, what was causing his fall, he saw a patch of ice. This patch of ice was approximately 1 foot by 2 feet, and it was adjacent to the entrance to this automatic door on the inside of the store. Mr. Janice reported this to the checkout clerk, Bev Nagel. She was, I believe, checkout stand number 2. Ms. Nagel inspected the site. She went over to take a look at where Mr. Janice had fallen. She observed that the rug had been pushed out and that there was, in fact, a patch of ice on the inside of the store.
Does the record reflect whether the ice was on top of the rug or underneath it?
It was underneath the rug.
So, and I assume it's not a clear rug, so you couldn't see the ice if the rug was covering it.
That's my understanding.
All right.
Reporting it to Ms. Nagel, she followed procedure, store procedure. She wrote out a report. The report accurately documents this incident. Mr. Janice reported his injuries. The incident was reported to the store manager, Mr. Mowry, the daytime store manager. Mr. Mowry, according to the general manager of the store, Mr. Weishflacker, had to put ice melt on this part of the floor, this tile. This is a tiled floor. Ice melt to dissolve the ice patch, which was, again, 1 foot by 2 feet in size. After apparently some time, it cleared itself up, and The location was marked off by a warning sign later, I believe. This, again, this area is a part of a store that has not changed since the store was built. The store was built in 1978. Even 6 years after this incident, the entrance has not changed, despite this incident. You have a set of doors, automatic doors, in this store using a rubber-backed matted servo rug as its form of safety to ensure that moisture doesn't collect at this site, at the entrance of its store. These facts were presented to the trial court. The trial court held that there was no duty on the part of the store to use reasonable care to so that this issue could go to a jury trial. The trial court held that this was not foreseeable. We are here today presenting these facts.
So you're saying the trial court held the ice underneath the rug was not foreseeable?
That's correct, Chief Justice.
Right.
And
who owned the rug?
I believe it was a commercial service that provided rugs to Nash Finch, and I don't believe it was owned by the store. They were replaced periodically, and the store, in addition, had a floor cleaning service, apparently. Despite the plaintiff's effort to obtain documentation of that service, the defendant states that believes that there was a floor cleaning service that nightly serviced this tiled floor. And by servicing it, it used water to mop and clean up the floor.
Was that entryway, did it have heat of any sort?
There is a heat vent, and it's, however, from the ceiling. It does not come from the floor.
And they didn't have... Was there any testimony on whether they normally ran a heater in the wintertime in that entryway?
There was not. There was not. Most stores in Rapid City have vestibules, a double set of doors. I believe most of Nash Finch's stores in Rapid City have two sets of doors. I believe this is the only store where it does not have two sets of doors. Nor does it have grates. Frequently, you see now in most commercial establishments for the business invitee, it provides in the entrance a type of insert into floor that are grates that absorbs the moisture, and these grates have slip resistant surface, and it's a measure that you see more and more often.
Was that all evidence and presented to the trial court? You're telling us here?
Justice Meyer, Henry, I believe that it was pursuant to all the depositions that were submitted, including the expert testimony of David Dalbert.
Was there any evidence about whether or not the floor was wet when the rug was placed on it? Was it the floor cleaning service that placed the rug, and did they place it on a wet floor? I didn't find anything.
There was not, Justice Severson. This situation is what was assumed by the store manager, Mallory, was that the moisture came from the floor cleaning service. This speculation didn't come up on the part of the plaintiff. It actually came from one of the defendant's witnesses.
All right. Well, that was my question. Was there testimony regarding that?
I'm sorry. And that is, I guess, the testimony related to that.
Okay.
So what is the duty, then, that business owes to its customers?
Mr. Francis Janice, it's undisputed, he was a business invitee. And as a business invitee, reasonable and ordinary care should have been used on part of this business to ensure that as he entered this commercial establishment that it was free of any hazards.
So there's a duty to inspect the premises? Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, Justice Konecamp, I believe so. I believe...
Is that South Dakota's law? Do we have a case that says that business owes a duty to inspect its premises to its customers?
Justice Konecamp, I don't believe a case says that on point. I believe there are recent cases, Curlin versus Halverson, and I think of particular interest is Pierce versus City of Belle Fourche. In that case, the City of Belle Fourche was responsible for providing tie-downs for the airport. And the plaintiff, in that matter, Mr. Pierce, had placed his plane there, used the city's tie-downs, and these tie-downs were determined to be weather-worn and during a windstorm had failed. And this court believed that using the totality of the circumstances test, that the city could have foreseen this occurring, and that that matter should not have been summarily ruled upon by the trial court. That should have went to the jury trial for a jury trial.
Did you argue that? I know that trial court relied upon a case where apparently the duty to inspect was rejected. A ladder case where a boarder is using a ladder that's owned by the proprietor. And the court apparently relied upon that case. Did you propose to the court that the restatement should be considered?
I believe that case was, Mortensen versus Braley. And that was a case decided before Small versus McKinnon. In Small versus McKinnon, this court had ruled away the old test of foreseeability being determined by similar acts and adopted a standard that came out of, I believe, the Isaacs versus Huntington, California case, where future cases should be determined by the standard of the totality of the circumstances. And I argued that that was the standard, that it is the standard in this case. The trial court held otherwise. And I believe the trial court committed two errors. First being that the undisputed facts in this case are for the non-moving party. They're strongly in favor of the non-moving party. We have a store that has immediately inside its perimeter a patch of ice. And I analogize it to perhaps somebody stepping into an elevator and inexplicably the elevator free falls. Mr. Janice stepped into the Prairie Market store and without any fault on his part, there's no evidence whatsoever of any contributory negligence or that he assumed any type of risk or that he had notice of this type of hazard. And this area of the store is obviously an area that's going to be heavily traveled. There's going to be business invitees coming to that area first and most frequently. Despite that, and despite the fact this store was the control of the management, is responsible for the cleaning of it, is responsible for the automatic doors, is responsible to make sure the heat was on this January morning. It was very cold, in fact, and my understanding that there was wind that night, where this defendant, this appellee here, had control of the instrumentalities, control of the management, so that only it could have prevented this from happening.
All right, you're talking in generalities here. What specifically should the store have done?
There are a number of things it could have done. Again, this is a store, to my knowledge, is the only one of Nash Finch's stores that does not have a double set of doors. It has not made any attempt over the last 32 years to redesign its storefront. I believe it's the only store in Rapid City that faces the north. It has its entrances on the north. So it could have done, again, a number of things. It could have had a different floor at that entrance. Instead of the asphalt tile that it uses, there could have been a carpet, a non-movable carpet, or if it were to use these service rugs, these rugs could have had a backing that would prevent them from slipping. The automatic doors could have been inspected and maintained better. Part of the...
Now, is all that presented to the... Is that argument, or did you actually present testimony? This would be reasonable.
Justice Meyer, hearing, that was part of... I believe that was entailed in the depositions. Some of it came from the defendant's own witnesses. Bev Nagel, who had worked for Nash Finch for approximately 25 years and had worked at this store since 1990, even stated that when I asked her, what would you do differently about the design of your entrance, and she stated that she would put double doors at that store, at the Prairie Market store. In addition, David Dalbert indicated that this was an accident waiting to happen. This was foreseeable.
Is it the case that there was no testimony or evidence, though, that there had anybody had slipped before there?
That is the trial court's, that weighed heavily on the trial court's decision.
You agree that there wasn't, no one, or you were not able to provide any testimony that someone else had slipped?
Not on ice, correct. There had been other people who had slipped on moisture.
Mm-hmm. And
In that area a number of times. And again, the defendant fairly states that the purpose of the rug was a safety measure, was to collect moisture. And so it is well known, I don't believe it's disputed, that this area of the store, if any area in the store, was going to be an area where moisture was going to gather. The store has employees that go out and collects the shopping carts that the patrons use and leave out in the parking lot. These shopping carts are brought back into the store through these double doors. In doing so, moisture is tracked in.
Let me ask you a legal question before you run out of time. It looks to me like you're out of court because the circuit court said Small versus McKinnon does not apply. That case is limited to protecting against third parties. So why was the trial court wrong on that legal analysis?
I believe Pierce versus the City of Belle Fourche is a case in point that states that it isn't. The totality of circumstances test does not just apply to third-party tortfeasors. That the totality of the circumstances standard is to be used on-premise liability cases in general. The issue on foreseeability is a significant factor in determining whether or not a store owner or a property owner has a duty to use reasonable and ordinary care. This factor is an elastic factor, and it should be viewed proportionately to the burden of foreseeability. We have, in Small versus McKinnon, a situation where somebody in the parking lot gets raped and killed. And this court held that the hospital could have foreseen that or should have been able to foreseen it, despite the fact that this had never occurred before. The foreseeability of that, I believe, is much greater than in this situation, where we have an entrance that is heavily traveled and undisputably moisture gathers, and unquestionably this was January, and using common experience in January in South Dakota, it is very foreseeable, when, unless you have a double set of doors, you only have one set of doors, that cold air coming in can create ice, can freeze a floor, a tiled floor. I analogize that to your garage in South Dakota. Even if you have a heated garage, the garage door comes down, and quite frequently you may have the ice and snow that melts off your vehicle puddle, but you look at the door, near your door, you'll still see ice and snow, because that's where it is the coldest. This was foreseeable, and if the trial court had used the standard of totality of circumstances, we believe that this this appellant here would have had the opportunity to present his case to us.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Thank you. Mr. Feifel, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Nelson. In multiple cases over the years, this court has very clearly defined a possessor's duty to a business invitee. That duty is one of reasonable and ordinary care. That general duty also includes the requirement to warn of known dangers. At no point in time, in any case that this court has ever considered, has it ever indicated that a landowner is an insurer of the safety of its premises, nor has it ever indicated that the standard is one akin to strict liability. And really, that is exactly what the appellant is requesting in this particular case. The trial court's finding in this particular case didn't state that there was no duty, as suggested by the appellant. What the trial court said on page 17 of the hearing transcript was that it was not the trial court's belief that a land possessor's duty included the duty to inspect minute details for hidden dangers. And that is exactly the thrust of the argument that the appellant presents to the court today.
Well, is it a jury question whether this is minute? This is the way you get into the building.
I'm sorry, pardon me, Your Honor.
Well, you used the word minute. I said, is it a jury question as to whether this was a minute defect? It was the only way for the public to get in the building.
It was, but the trial court's finding was that there was no obligation to inspect. And in this particular case, I think it's important to note how both parties have described the alleged dangerous condition. In at least four separate places within the appellant's briefing, the defect is described as hidden and latent. This court has had the opportunity to look at what latent means under South Dakota law. In the Knutson versus Jensen case. In that case, this court defined latent as meaning something which would not be discovered by reasonable and customary observation or inspection.
Well, on that though, if the store through itself or people it hired mopped the floor and put a rug over the top of it, how is that latent if they actually did it? And whether it's in the form of moisture, wet, or ice, isn't that foreseeable that that's going to be slippery if you put a rug on moisture?
Well, I think that's the key here is that, Your Honor, there wasn't any indication that anyone was aware that there was anything that would suggest that there was ice underneath the rug. And in fact, the testimony was very clear that there was absolutely no evidence to suggest how the ice had formed.
Well, wasn't there asked the same question to Mr. Nelson of whether or not the cleaning service actually mopped the floor and left the moisture, and isn't that a jury question of whether or not they left the moisture there and put the rug on top of it?
I think it's certainly possible that the cleaning crew left a film of moisture that froze underneath the rug.
But, well, isn't the store responsible? That's their employee. That isn't an outside group that comes in and does that. Under their direction.
And I understand that this cleaning service was hired by the store. But the issue is that once the vestibule area of the store is finished for the evening by the cleaning crew, and we come in the morning, and the testimony on this is clear. There were a number of different areas that I think, as Justice Meyer Henry noted, are more akin to argument that the plaintiff raises in this particular case. But the testimony was clear on this fact. The area was heated. There is an overhead heater in this area of the store, and there had never, in 30-plus years, ever been a situation like this that anyone had ever noticed. The area was well-lighted. The rugs were clean and dry, and the sidewalks entering the area of the vestibule were clean and dry. In other words, there was simply no evidence to suggest that there was anyone that could have been aware that there was ice underneath this particular rug. And what that does, Your Honor, is leads one to exactly the place where the trial court went, which is this question of a duty to inspect. The plaintiff made very clear in his brief that that's what he believes the law to be. In his brief, he said that the course of a reasonable landowner, which should have been taken by Nash Finch in this particular case, was to lift up and look underneath the rug that morning, despite the fact the rug was clean and dry, the area was dry, the sidewalks had been cleared and were dry, and there was no suggestion that there was a problem anywhere. That's well beyond any suggestion of reasonable duty that this court has ever looked at in any case that it has ever been decided.
Well, you know that Justice Henderson dissented in that case that the trial court relied on, the Braley decision, urging that there should be a duty to inspect. Are South Dakota customers being shortchanged when we don't require business owners to inspect their premises to make sure that there aren't defects that could injure them?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because two things. One of which is, I think the decision in Mortenson versus Braley, along with subsequent decisions that this court has issued over the years, has generally followed the common law restatement standard, which is that of ordinary and reasonable care, and warn of known dangers. At no point has the court ever suggested that there's an obligation to look for unknown dangers.
I don't think we have. But, you know, when I look around the country, and when I look at Prosser and other treatises, many courts say, including Prosser, the duty of care includes the affirmative obligation to perform an inspection to discover the premises' actual condition and any latent defects. That seems to be the law around the country. South Dakota seems to be in the minority on that. Is it perhaps time for us to re-examine that rule and decide that South Dakota business customers are entitled to the same kind of protections that many other states' customers have?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but two comments, one of which is that particular request for a change in the law as it relates to an additional duty beyond the reasonable person standard, or perhaps an expansion of that standard, was never presented by the appellate to the trial court. So I don't think it's right for consideration by this court in this particular case. Because
you're saying that the restatement that Justice Henderson argued should be adopted in Braley, and I think other writings of his, I see it cited in the appellant's brief now, but you're saying it wasn't argued or raised at the trial level?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. That particular issue, that there ought to be some, that particular question of the Prosser suggestion that there ought to be a duty to inspect for a latent defect was not an issue that was broached at the time the trial court considered the summary judgment motion. But additionally, I think that The issue becomes one that the trial court recognized, which was, if we assume that there's going to be a change in what South Dakota has said, and that we're going to add a duty to inspect as part of a landowner's duty, then the question becomes, to what end do we take that particular standard? And I think the trial court recognized that in this particular case by use of the word minute detail. This case, I think it was clear that based upon all reasonable, observable standards that the store had available to it, this was a hidden, latent defect. Those are the terms that plaintiff himself uses to describe what the condition was. And I think to suggest that a store owner has the duty to lift every rug, look at every particular can of tuna to see whether one was jostled by a customer, is a difficult standard, if not impossible standard, for a landowner to meet in terms of how does that occur and in what manner does that occur.
Mr. Feifle, though, as I read the transcript of the trial court's decision, the trial court didn't decide duty simply on duty to inspect. The trial court clearly talked about small and talked about the totality of the circumstances and rejected that standard. So it seems to me, yes, there is that language about minute inspection, but right before that, the court's talking about should they reasonably be held to suspect something that's never been a possibility before. So I think didn't the court really look at both legal issues?
Well, I don't think
the totality of the circumstances versus the particular prior injury.
I don't think there's any question that the trial court looked at a number of different factors in reaching its decision. In that colloquy that you're referring to, Justice Jenner, the trial court very clearly said he didn't believe that Small applied on its facts to this particular case. I don't know that it's a fair argument to make that he rejected out of hand a totality of the circumstances review, but certainly indicated he didn't believe that Small applied on its facts to this particular case.
So don't we have to decide that? And then I want you to tell me why Small why shouldn't we apply Small in this case?
Well, assuming that a totality review is one that it is applicable, I don't think there's any question that we reach the same conclusion. And because in Kierlin and the other cases that this court has looked at as it relates to that particular standard, the court has very clearly indicated that in those sorts of cases, the court must find that the risk defined is within the standard of hazards that a reasonable person would expect. So in this particular case, we're looking at, which is really well-settled law in the state of South Dakota, that one is not required under a duty standard to anticipate risks that a reasonable person would not believe exist. And I think in this particular case, that's exactly where we went. Because of the fact that this was a hidden, latent defect, this was not reasonable to anticipate. That is exactly what the Kierlin court talked about when it raised the issue of whether or not totality was an appropriate standard.
All right, then let me take you one more step. If it's what a reasonable person should expect, is that a jury question or a question for the court? Because the existence of a duty, we all know, is a question for the court, but we have a reasonable person standard here.
It becomes a little bit convoluted,
yeah.
and I understand, and frankly, my confusion was raised a little bit by reading through some of these cases, because the court has, in a number of cases, talked about the issue of foreseeability, both in terms of the duty context and in terms of the fact context. And the court has very clearly indicated, however, that when one talks about duty in terms of one talks about foreseeability in terms of the duty context, that is always a question of law for the court. When one talks about foreseeability in terms of the fact context, that in more cases cannot than not can be a jury question.
And of course, you know where I'm going here because you just said it's a reasonable person standard, and we always say that that's up to a jury to decide that question.
Well, and I understand that, but the issue is what does one get to the duty question based upon that particular standard when one talks about the foreseeability of the risk in terms of what the Curlin courts said. And in that particular case, I'm trying to find exactly what I want to talk about. When the court was looking at the totality question in Curlin, and that's the case where the two individuals got into a fight on top of the roof of a building, and the question was, because of some prior conflict that had occurred between the employees of these two separate companies, should there have been some foreseeability about the fact that this particular incident could occur? And in that case, the court talked about the totality of the circumstances review as it related to the duty question by stating this: the exact harm need not be foreseen. Rather, the harm need only be within the class of reasonably foreseeable hazards that the duty exists to protect. So I think when one reads Curlin, Your Honor, we already talk about when we use the totality circumstance that the court's assuming that there's been a violation of the duty because it talks about the fact that we review these hazards and risks in terms of what the duty is designed to protect. So my reading is that when we look at these totality cases, all of which have been in some form or fashion talking about third party or third actor conduct, by the way. But the court, in fairness, hasn't specifically said we limit it only to those cases. But every case that I have read that it has looked at that has all been, do we look at the totality and looking at whether or not it was foreseeable that there might be some action by this third party? But in any event, when one looks at that particular issue as it relates to the totality foreseeability question, the assumption has already been made that there's a duty, and that duty, the risk that is foreseeable, has already been violated, because that's what the harm question looks at as raised by this court in Curlin. So the answer really is, I think, the same regardless of which particular manner we go down the road, is that there is absolutely no case that this court has ever indicated that one is required to anticipate a risk that's beyond one that is reasonable for a person to look at. So whether we look...
In order to... What you're saying is we'd almost have to go the next step and adopt a duty to inspect.
I don't think that there's any question that the manner in which this particular case sits before the court, in that we had a clear entryway area, we had a problem that had never occurred ever before, that one has to take the next step and indicate that there's a duty to inspect. That to me is the only, that is the thrust, I think, of the plaintiff's argument in terms of how the case was presented. That's the statement that was made in the brief, that the reasonable person standard was such that the store had an obligation and a duty to look underneath this rug and expect for a hidden latent defect.
What about the fact that they hired, I mean, those were employees, that, let's assume, if you look at the facts most favorable, that the people that did the floor left water there. Is a store then, I mean, if those were people that were hired by the store and store's employees, aren't they, don't their actions impute to the employer?
First of all, I don't think that there's any evidence in the record to suggest how the ice was formed. I think there's been some suggestion about how the store faced and whether or not the store remodeled and some other argument type issues, none of which are facts in the record which would indicate that there was something that was causative in terms of this ice formation. The evidence is that there was a store cleaning service. I think the testimony of the store manager was that this was a contracted group, and so it's an independent contractor that did it. I'm not sure it makes much difference, Justice Meyer-Henry, in terms of where we end up, because This is, by all admissions of, including that of the plaintiff, a hidden, latent defect. In other words, it is, was not reasonable for it to be otherwise seen. And the only way we get to liability on the store is to take the next step and require that there be some inspection for latent defects on a landowner's property. And this court has never required that under the reasonable person standard in looking at the duty question. I think this case, Your Honors, presents the type of case, even if one looks at the totality standard and some of the cases therein in which this court has affirmed summary judgment, it presents scant evidence to suggest that there were any circumstances. And by evidence, I mean evidence in the record, not argument, not suggestion that there are other stores around the country or whatnot. Scant evidence to suggest that the landowner or the land possessor of the store in this particular case had any knowledge of or reason to have knowledge of a hidden, latent defect, and that absent that evidence, the court appropriately reached summary judgment on the duty question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feifley. Mr. Nelson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I believe this is a great opportunity for this court to clear up what appears to be some confusion at the trial court level. That confusion is whether or not the totality of the circumstances standard will, should apply to situations like this for business invitees. Despite what I believe this court has already done to make that clear, that being Pierce versus the city of Belle Fourche, there appears to be some further need for a clarification on this. In regards to Mr. Feifley's claim that the store did not even assume a duty here to inspect this area, the interrogatories submitted to the defendant, he or the Nash Finch had replied in this question, or I sought, please state whether at the time of the incident you employed maintenance workers or other similar personnel to protect persons coming on the subject premises from injury due to unsafe floor conditions. Their answer was yes. Bev Nagel's testimony, her deposition transcript submitted to the trial court, indicated that the stock boys who came on duty that morning on the 28th of January, there were six employees at that time. One of their duties was to go out to make sure that the sidewalk was clear, to shovel any snow, any blown in debris that may have accumulated at the entrance. So I believe the store assumed the duty and failed. And we did not, the plaintiff here did not have the opportunity to take this matter to trial because the trial court used the wrong standard. That being that we had to show a similar act had occurred before the store could reasonably be on notice to have foreseen this incident occurring. The public policy against that standard is this. We want to encourage property owners to find hazards, to go out and see that their property is safe for business invitees by allowing the trial court to use the similar act standard in this situation does not promote that public policy. That standard also is arbitrary. The similar acts standard where the plaintiff in each case has to show that something else had occurred that was very similar to what occurred in that person's case in order to impose a duty upon the property owner is a difficult burden. And each trial court can arbitrarily decide that, well, this patch of ice was not at this, was at the west set of doors, not at the east set of doors. So if it occurred prior to the, you know, at the same set of doors, then you would have a similar act and therefore there would be a duty. That becomes arbitrary. Using that standard too, it can be arbitrary as to the time, how recent was the similar act. Another public policy against using that standard is that it equates foreseeability to a similar act. And reasonable people can reasonably foresee things that are dangerous, whether they've occurred or not in the past. And lastly, the public policy in favor of using the totality of the circumstances and against the standard that this trial court used is that it takes too many cases away from the jury. There are a number of disputed facts in this matter, and one of them, again, being whether or not this store, its employees, should have detected and observed a hazardous condition at its entrance. And if it has employees who have one of their responsibilities as being to go out and making sure that the entrance is safe, I think the jury could have reasonably decided that they breached that duty. But again, the plaintiff here did not get that opportunity to present this case to a jury. And it was summarily decided by the trial court.
Before you run out of time, I wanted to ask you about go back to this duty to inspect. And I see you did raise that in your brief, Restatement of Torts, Section 343. Did you argue that in front of the, Mr. Feifley says you did not raise that in front of the trial court or raise the issue of duty to inspect. Did you raise that issue?
I did not, okay. Justice Konecamp. The situation was I participated in the hearing while I was here for another oral argument, so it was done telephonically. And I was in Vermilion at the time. So it was kind of an awkward situation, but I did not raise that at that point.
And I didn't really hear you arguing today that we should adopt a duty to inspect rule. You're really more focused on totality of the circumstances. As I hear your argument, is that fair or not?
That and the fact that the trial court did not put the facts in the most favorable light to the non-moving party here. It clearly did not. Despite all the facts we presented to the trial court was stuck on this idea that, well, the main fact he didn't present here is the fact that this had occurred before. So it put aside all these other nuances, these minute minutiae, detail that this was a tiled floor, that this was a serval rug that had to, on a number of occasions before, had to be put back in place by the Nash Finch employees, that this was only one set of doors that didn't have a vestibule, didn't have a double set, that this was foreseeable in January. So all those facts were not given any weight. The main consideration for the trial court, can you point to me a similar incident? And the plaintiff was not able to. That concludes my argument.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.